This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Antonio Negri went to prison in his native Italy for his political views, in particular his support for the autonomy movement of the 1970s. And while he was in prison, he was elected to parliament, and that allowed him to escape to Paris, where he lived in exile for many years. In Paris, Negri was approached by a young American named Michael Hart. Michael had been translating some of Negri's writings in English. Eventually, the two of them worked together. Their first book, Empire, came out in 2000, and it was called The Communist Manifesto of the 21st Century. The two were hailed as the Marx and Engels of the Internet Age. They co-authored two other books together shortly after that. They are sometimes called the Empire Trilogy. Their work describes a new kind of imperialism in the globalized economy and envisions ways to bring about radical change. Michael Hart is chair of the Literature Department at Duke and my guest today on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Nice to be here.
Now, we're going to start with your brand new book, Declaration. I want to talk about some of these other things in your history and how you got to meet Antonio Negri and all of that. But this new book, simply titled Declaration, is a response to the Occupy movement, the various encampments and occupations around the world. It's also a collaboration with Negri. A declaration in response to the Occupy movement. Tell us how this new book came about.
Well, it first comes about really with our recognition that two things, really. First, that Occupy Wall Street was clearly an economic protest, a protest against economic inequality, economic injustice, the role of the banks, finance, etc. But it was also, importantly, a political protest about the lack of democracy in our society, along with various experiments to create more democratic forms. So that was one point in writing our book, a foundational point. And the other one was to recognize that the Occupy movement really didn't start in New York or even in the U.S., but rather emerged from an entire year of struggles that stretched back certainly to the encampments in the central squares in Spain starting in May 15th of 2011, and those themselves that were inspired by the Arab Spring and particularly the encampments in Tahrir Square. So contextualizing the Occupy movement of the U.S. in this longer framework, that itself in a way helps us with the first point of bringing out the political content or the political challenge, let's say, of this cycle of struggles of the last
year.
And
you happened to be in Spain at the time those encampments. Was that true or shortly after?
I wasn't in Spain during the May encampments. I was in Spain afterwards and talking to many of them. I also wasn't in Wall Street in September. So I was at none of the what would you call it, ground zero of any of the events. But what Tony, my co-author, and I have been trying to do is to recognize in a way their common demands and common aspirations, and both to recognize the successes that they've had so far and to look forward about what they could become.
And you say that, in a sense, what the media and others have complained about in these movements is precisely the point of the movement and perhaps some of its power. It is decentralized authority and modeling, in a sense, this new kind of democracy, a real democracy, that is part of the goal.
Absolutely. You know, one of the major slogans in Spain in these occupations in May before Occupy Wall Street was one of their slogans or demands was real democracy now. And they're going along with that was a slogan that you don't represent us, not only against one politician or one political party, but against the entire political system of representation. So that they were experimenting in the square, organizing the square, occupying the square with creating in miniature in the square new forms of democratic participation. So against representation, which seems to me a quite dramatic and radical political challenge, and therefore experimenting with forms like the General Assembly form for collective direct participation in decision making.
Is representation a bad thing?
Representation is certainly not the worst thing. One should remember from reading the Federalist Papers when you were in high school, that representation is conceived there by Madison in particular as a bulwark against democracy. It's both something that connects us to those in power, but also a mechanism to separate us from them. It's certainly different. Representation is certainly different from direct participation in government. And so that's what – I mean, this is a longstanding division or controversy or political debate within the U.S. tradition as in others between democracy conceived as direct participation and representation as a limitation of that.
Well, in Declaration, you begin the book with this sentence, "This is not a manifesto." And then you compare manifesto and, in a sense, say that political organizing now is sort of through the looking glass when it came to our understanding of change, revolution in the past.
Yeah, you know, I'm very attracted to manifestos, of course, to their energy, to their vision, to their political engagement. One thing that characterizes manifestos, though, and this already in the sentence after that, we say that manifestos are something like the ancient prophets. And what the ancient prophets do is they create, by the power of their visions, they create a people. They bring into being a people that can enact this new world. And that's in a way what manifestos are meant to do. They're meant also to create a people. And so that's what it seemed to us that the contemporary movements have made both prophets and manifestos obsolete, because they are already in the process of posing new truths and new principles that can envision and new visions of a new society. That's something. It's that declaration of our title. That's what we think that the movements of the last year have done. They've managed to declare, in some sense, like the Declaration of Independence. They've been able to declare new truths and new principles.
But it seems to me that what you're also saying is that it's that the sequence has changed, that before you
Right.
declared your independence, fought for your independence, and then created a new society. We'll have this debate through the Federalist Papers and others, and over time we'll make the thing that we now have the chance to do because we overthrew the old regime. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is, under this new structure, we're creating the new ideas, the new systems, right under the nose of and in the process of the old order. It's right there. It's right among us.
I mean, that's certainly true, that the process is or and should be and is more powerfully creating a new society in the shell of the old. And that is something that I would say is happening within these movements. The historical illusion that we're drawing on, too, with this notion of declaration is that one of the tasks that seems to us most important facing the movements of the last year is to make lasting, durable social forms. You know, like, they've been very good in the last year at organizing a square or a park for a few months. What they haven't been so good at is transforming an entire social organization in a lasting way. So in some sense, the movement from declaration to constitution or, so we're thinking in a way, you know, from 1776 to 1780s to that movement of creating lasting relationships, a constituent process, that's what we call it. That seems to us the greatest challenge facing these movements. How can we build on the principles and the new common truths that have been created in the movements and create out of them lasting social relationships?
So the old slogan, "A revolution is an old society pregnant with a new one," is changed by saying it's an old society with a new one coming of age under its roof. And these experiments, some will fail and some won't, and the successful ones may be the new order. Is that your sense? Is that your sense of how this may evolve, that we may see a kind of a new order, a sort of a Darwinian evolution going on right under our noses?
I think it's true that what we need to do, and this is, I think, what is often being done in these movements, the most powerful thing done in these movements, is to experiment with and to create new social arrangements, create a new social alternative by themselves. So that, I mean, obviously, in any notion of revolution or of social change, really, there has to be a break with the contemporary social order. And then, of course, there's no guarantee that they will spontaneously be formed a new and better one. What I think the focus on here is not only on the break. The break is certainly important. Attack the critical power of these movements is certainly important, but also equally important, or maybe even more important, is this constituent power of projecting new social arrangements and new social relationships.
We'll talk more about how that might happen in the days and years ahead. My guest this hour, Michael Hart, a political theorist and director of the chair of the literature program at Duke. His new book with Antonio Negri is called Declaration, and just ahead we'll take a look at how political movements in Latin America and Italy in decades past shaped Michael Hart on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow talking to Michael Hart today, prominent political theorist, also the chair of the literature department at Duke University. And as you said earlier, you really didn't start out to be a political theorist, did you?
Well, as an undergraduate, I was an engineer, which in some ways seemed to me at the time like a political choice. It was during this was the very early 1980s, energy crisis, need for alternative energies, appropriate technologies for the third world. It seemed like doing something practical. So in some sense, I was, I was probably mistaken. But I thought of it as a political choice and a political activity.
So you were politically conscious, you would say, at the time, but that was the choice you made, not to become an activist, not to become a theorist, but to do something that would make the world a better place.
That seemed reasonable at the time, and that's all I could see to do.
So what brought you to Latin America then?
Well, I think a large portion of my generation. You know, I was graduated in university in 1983. A large fraction of us who had, what do you say, even revolutionary desires, it seemed like the only thing to do. That after the success of the Nicaraguan Revolution in 1979, the civil wars in Guatemala and El Salvador, it seemed impossible to do the kind of political work that interested us in the U.S., and that seemed like something we could learn from. In fact, when I was a kid, I didn't do anything particularly important or inspirational in any of these. But I learned an awful lot. And you know what I learned most actually is really the joy of political struggle. You know, I realized that whereas at least in my circles in the U.S., politics had seemed a kind of political activism seemed kind of like a moral activity of denunciation and shame, whereas what I learned, especially in El Salvador, was politics being, you know, a joyful life activity. And that was an enormous gift for me.
Well, you say you learned that, but you must have in some ways missed it. If you didn't learn it until you went to El Salvador, you must have had a sense that there was something missing in the American scene.
Yeah, I certainly learned that when I was there, right? But in the U.S. scene, I mean, it was during Reagan's presidency. I couldn't, but this is probably my own lacking or lacking many in my group. They couldn't see other ways in the U.S. of acting politically in ways that seemed satisfying to us.
So what was your plan? What were you going to do?
Oh, I didn't have a plan. I was a kid. my friends and I started with was what was called then the Sanctuary Movement, which was a movement started mostly in churches in the U.S. to bring Guatemalan and Salvadoran refugees north illegally across the border, have them stay in churches, hence the sanctuary, and they would speak their story to as an educational project, really, for the U.S. population. So I started with a friend. We went to Mexico City as a contact person to help refugees to bring them north. And in fact, after our frustrations with the movement, went to El Salvador, and really there were mostly associated with the university students at the University of El Salvador.
What were those frustrations?
Oh, these were just small frustrations of any political group. In some ways, it was the conflict between the religious center of the sanctuary movement and the non-religious political one. The here it might sound very, very minor to you, but the part of the directives for choosing the refugees to bring north was supposedly those who were in the most need. But really what they wanted were those who had the best stories. And so that conflict or seeming hypocrisy between these directives. But I think what really attracted us more was the way that the Salvadorans did politics. And it seemed a breath of fresh air from the kind of political activity that we had found, you know, open to us in the U.S.
Well, how is that different?
Well, like I say, I think that you know, both thinking of politics as a doing politics as a life vocation, and also the joyful character of it, you know, struggling together and struggling for oneself. That was something that, I mean, also, of course, that, you know, in El Salvador, political engagements always ended in dancing, too. So there was other, whatever, cultural characteristics of it. But I think more that the joy of struggle is what seemed apparent.
What do you think is different there? Why is that not part of the American political activity?
You know, I think now, I think there's a great deal of change in U.S. activism since, maybe even since the 1990s, things that could have been traced maybe to ACT UP and Queer Nation, but certainly were prevalent starting in 1999 with the globalization protest movements. I think new generations of activists are really quite different than those who were in their 20s in the 1980s as I was. So I think there's been a great transformation.
You were clearly energized and inspired by the way they did politics down there. Was it transferable? Did you find that you could actually bring those ideas back to the U.S.?
No, that was one of my frustrations was that it seemed that we U.S.ers, you know, in Latin America, or in Central America at the time, that we were helping, mostly observing someone else's revolution, and that the kinds of struggle and the terms of struggle were very different than what was necessary and appropriate in the U.S. There was one event that seemed really significant for me at the time and crystallized my thinking about it. I don't know if it could seem interesting to you in retrospect. It was at a meeting of this student organization at the University of El Salvador, and my partner and I, we were the guests, and they were grateful. You know, they start out, we're grateful for the North American colleagues to come help us. But then they continue to say, but, you know, what would really help us is if you go home and make revolution in the U.S. That would be what would really help us. And I thought, okay. You know, so I responded, actually. I said, I don't know what that means. I don't even know how to do that. And so he said to me, well, he said, you have mountains, don't you? And I said, yeah, we have mountains. And he says, it's simple. You just form an art band, go to the mountains, you make revolution. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, like that it seemed to be both suicidal and counterproductive. And that led me, I mean, I think quite logically, to start thinking differently about what the transformations of U.S. society could involve, and which at the time seemed completely unimaginable to me.
Did you? But you made that, in a sense, the focus of your intellectual activity. You said, "I think I'm going to try to answer that question." And his answer seems inappropriate. So how do we you know get to this?
Right. You're reading in retretrospect, though, a life that's much. I mean, our lives are much more confused than that.
Not mine. That's exactly how mine went.
But one could say that there's some ways in which. I mean, what I did feel like. Leaping forward 15 years, I did feel that in collaboration with Tony Negri, what I felt really successful about in this book, Empire of Ours, that we published in 2000, so yes, 15 years after that, I did feel that that we had a way of understanding the world that I finally felt satisfying. I mean, of course, we might be wrong. We have a number of hypotheses. I mean, we think we're right, but it was an attempt to understand the way that the world is changing and to grasp the new political order, and hence also grasp the ways of of struggling against it, of creating something new.
So for those of us who may not have known or who may have forgotten, tell us about Antonio Negri and his history.
It's a complicated story. I'll give you the short version, see if you can figure the parts from it. I mean, he was a university professor of political science in Padua in northeastern Italy in the early 1960s, involved with worker movements, worker and student movements. In fact, involved with the segment of the worker movements outside of the Communist Party and its unions, they say to the left of the party, which believed in the autonomy of the workers, that the workers could, instead of being represented by union leaders or party leaders, that the workers could speak for themselves and organize for themselves and act for themselves. And that organization developed through the 1960s into the 1970s, and the 1970s really transformed into what they more generalized the notion of autonomy, not only workers' autonomy, but a kind of social network of autonomous, regionally autonomous groups, but also autonomous groups like organized workers, organized unemployed people. Feminist organizations were just blossoming then. Even gay and lesbian groups were starting. That this network of autonomy was, in a way, what sustained the movements in the 70s, together with what they called free radio stations, occupied social spaces. They created a network of an alternative society. That's what they were in combating the dominant Italian society at the time. He was then the complications start at the same time arising. This autonomous movement in Italy in the 1970s also arose left terrorist groups, the Red Brigades being the most well known of these. And they some ways grew out of the same social milieu outside of the Communist Party, frustrated with and struggling against the current regime. There, of course, difference in their organization, their practices, the terrorist groups and the non-terrorist groups. Particularly the activities, the repression of the Italian government really changed in 1978 after the assassination of Aldo Moro by the Red Brigades. Aldo Moro was the most prominent politician in the country, the Christian Democratic politician. He was kidnapped by the Red Brigades, held for 40 days, assassinated. And the emergency laws passed afterward were sort of operated under the principle of if you drain the water, the fish will die. So it wasn't only directing against terrorist groups, but rather trying to evacuate this entire left political area of the country. And so there were mass arrests by these political laws, mass arrests, and people could be held for 2 years without being charged, and 4 years without coming to trial. So Tony was the most prominent person arrested under these laws. He was held for 2 years without being charged. He was then charged quite extraordinary, you might even think flattering if it wasn't be a problem, charges, armed insurrection against the state. They accused him of being the secret leader of all terrorist groups in Europe, not only the Red Brigades, etc. After 4 years, he was coming to trial. At that point, he was elected to parliament as a protest, really, against these emergency laws and the thousands of people who were being held in prison. So he was, by an Italian law, he, as a member of parliament, he couldn't be held for a political crime. So they had to let him out of prison. You can see the Hollywood potential of this, can't you? I mean,
well, first of all, the idea – first, let me just stop you there. The idea that the Italians would be so incensed by these emergency laws that have robbed them of their civil liberties, or at least some section, that they would actually elect a representative to say this is our protest against these laws that have gone too far. That alone is kind of a striking story.
It is. It is an interesting story. And then even the being – released from prison in order to conduct that. You know, so his real mandate as he served in parliament for those 2 months was to argue against these laws, which had thousands in prison and also in exile. So it had created quite a havoc in Italian society at the time, and certainly on this wing of the left, let's call it.
Right. But he also then took that opportunity to go into exile himself in Paris.
Right. So after 2 months, the parliament went on strike to rescind his immunity, to send him back to prison. At that point, of course, he escaped by secret means, etc. And the French government refused to recognize Italy's extradition requests because they, along with Amnesty International, thought that the charges were were illegitimate. So he remained there in exile for 14 years in Paris, and that's where we met.
And tell us about that, how you two came together.
At the time, 1986, I believe, Tony was clandestine in Paris. He couldn't – part of the agreement of the French government was that he could – a rather ambiguous mandate that he could do nothing public, which he tested in different ways. But I figured, you know, like, who was I? I was a graduate student in the U.S., just a regular kid. And so anyway, I translated a book of his in order to meet him, really. And so through friends, got in touch with him that I had translation questions, which indeed I did. He called me up and said, why don't you come to Paris for a week? And I went to Paris for a week, and we talked about translation problems, other things, and got along. And he said, why don't you move to Paris? We'll do things together. You know, we'll figure. And so I moved to Paris.
And how did the idea – tell us about the ideas that are at the foundation of Empire. Maybe I'll take you one step back and talk about this autonomy movement. How threatening was that? I mean, clearly, if you take a look at the charges, I mean, everything, I think, short of the fall of Rome, he was charged with. And so clearly he had been on their mind. But was there much effort to get him off the scene before the terrorist groups appeared? How threatening was the autonomy movement to Italian politics, to Italian social order, before things got violent?
You know, that's very difficult to interpret, and in some ways, it was the Communist Party that was the most, strongest in their repression against these groups on the left. One element of Italian history that also functions within this was that in the mid 70s, the Italian Communist Party was making what they called an historic compromise with the dominant party in order to enter into government. And so these social disorder on the left was seen as a threat to their by the Communist Party to their ambitions to enter into the government. You know, they at the time thought they were making revolution. They at the time thought that the social transformation was right around the corner. It's very difficult to evaluate these things in retrospect. What is true and what I found most inspiring was reading about what had gone on in Italy in the 70s. It seemed to me like the kinds of transformations and the kinds of social movements that would be appropriate in the U.S. too, that they seemed to me something new and quite powerful and inspiring. So that I think that the movements themselves, regardless of whether they could have transformed the Italian social order at the time, accomplished a great deal.
And this is these are some of the ideas at the heart of Empire, the idea that global social order is changing and it's going to change the way any kind of resistance to it looks. It can't look like the way Marx had envisioned it because he couldn't imagine this world.
That's certainly true. I mean, certainly true that on the one hand, this question about what the global emerging global power structure is not just an academic question. It also has important consequences for what kinds of movements are appropriate to combat it and how it can be transformed. The other thing that I think is quite consonant between these Italian experiments in the 1970s right up until Occupy Wall Street is an experimentation with a new and more democratic form of political organizing. So gone are the vanguard parties with the ideological line that's imposed, the centralized leadership, the representative spokespeople, and instead is an experiment with democracy where all can participate and in a horizontal network. I mean, by horizontal here, I mean, if you think about the vertical being the leader, or the vertical being the one who commands even the party or the central group or even the representatives would be somehow vertical. What we're trying to imagine here and what they're trying to imagine starting there in the 1970s in Italy is they imagine autonomy being that way as a horizontal relationship in which all participate and decisions are made collectively. So I think right up to the notion of the General Assembly that's functioned in the past year, that's that inspiration for a new democracy is part of the agenda.
I'm going to take a break here and come back and talk about how the logic behind that and how that makes sense in a global economic structure where the nation state with its hierarchies is declining in power as well. My guest this hour, Michael Hart, political theorist, new book on the Occupy movement called Declaration, and he's the chair of the literature program at Duke. Our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. My guest is Michael Hart, chair of Duke's Literature Department, also known for political writings. He collaborates with Antonio Negri. They have been writing for some time now. Their trilogy, The Empire Trilogy, of course, very well known. Their latest book, Declaration. We were talking about these new political movements in the face of what is a vastly different structure. You're not looking at a nation state now with its hierarchies and its political parties. So to organize that way in resistance simply doesn't make sense anymore, does it?
That's certainly our thinking about it. I mean, that's the way we conceive the emerging global order as not being, you know, a certain kind of thinking on the left has functioned, especially in Europe, Latin America, and the U.S., is that the U.S. is the dominant global power that dictates some notion of U.S. imperialism as what defines global order. And our hypothesis has been, and what we've been working through, is to think, well, not the U.S. nor any other nation state is capable of dictating global order today, but rather a complex network of powers that include the dominant nation states, certainly, but also the major corporations, the supranational organizations like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank, that these a collaboration among this network of powers. And so you're right. If global power is that kind of distributed network, of course hierarchical, of course dominating, of course isolated – but if it is that, then you have to have a different kind of mode of attack. You know, there's no Winter Palace to overthrow. You know, if you think about the Bolshevik Revolution, where is power? The czars are in the Winter Palace. You overthrow the Winter Palace, you make revolution. It poses a great challenge if one's going to imagine that it's not power isolated in one place, but rather distributed through a system. One has to invent new means of social protest and more important, social transformation.
And here's where your idea of the multitudes, I think, comes into play, an idea that owes something to Spinoza as well, but the idea that these new networks, social networks, that really transcend or pass through race, cultural, class bounds. This is something that sort of upsets some of classic Marxist theory, that these new networks are precisely the kinds of things that might be effective. And let me ask you this. Let me take it one step further, because to some extent it's also sort of a question of being unrecognizable. If you think of this in biological terms, right? I mean, if there's a kind of infection, the immune system learns to recognize it. If you're unrecognizable to the system, particularly if you're able to build to critical mass before you're recognized, you could be far more effective. It's a bunch of people hanging out in tents, on Wall Street. How useless is that? I don't have to worry about them.
Well, you certainly pick up on the anonymity of the Occupy movement and the masks with that. And I do think, I mean, the way I see this notion of multitude is really a project. And social movements today, the most powerful ones, the most interesting ones in my mind, are characterized both by heterogeneity, you know, that, like you said, that they're not just young people, not just old people of different races, of different religious beliefs, etc., and also the lack of leaders or centralized command. So that, for instance, you know, in Tahrir Square, what seemed whatever strange or amusing to me is during those 18 days of Tahrir Square, every day in the New York Times, the journalists tried to find a leader. Like one day, it's the Nobel Prize winner. One day, it's the Google executive. One day, each day, they tried to find a new leader. But what they couldn't understand is that this complexly organized, differentiated group of people in Tahrir Square didn't have a leader and didn't have – there was no one behind the scenes outside the square or in the square. So the challenge – I think that's the condition we have to face in organizing. The challenge then is how to make this horizontal, heterogeneous group effective in transforming its command and allow it to be able to act together in a lasting, long-lasting way. That's what seems to me the challenge for the kinds of organization today and what we mean by a project of multitude is to make this lasting and powerful form of organization.
So, but you're using terms like how to make it or the challenge or the project. And yet when I read your work, I get the sense of, and you should pardon the expression, an invisible hand at work. To some extent, and I'll go back to the biological analogy. You know, biologists now realize that bacteria, you know, get into your system in ones and twos. They would easily be overwhelmed when they first attack. They have to get to critical mass. The question for biologists is, well, how do they do that? How do they get to critical mass to become pathogenic before they get overwhelmed? And the answer is they don't act pathogenic. They don't act like a bacteria until they have enough. Mm-hmm. And they communicate to each other. And when they get up to critical mass, then they say, ah, now let's start acting like bacteria. Is there some kind of, again, unseen force, something that there's no requirement for somebody to be in charge of this thing in order for that sort of critical mass to develop and then express itself as the resistance?
I do think that when we say multitude or when we talk about the heterogeneity or leaderlessness of these movements, that doesn't mean no organization. In fact, it requires more organization in order to make decisions effectively and collectively and democratically and to also to overcome any number of hidden hierarchies within them. But I think something also you're getting at with this analogy, which seems interesting to me, is that Tony and I have never thought that we're the ones that were going to come up with answers to these questions. I think that it's rather that these movements are much more intelligent, like that recognizing the intelligence of the movements and the kinds of solutions to not only practical but also theoretical problems that are – and kind of what we can – I mean, I think what the kind of things we're trying to do like in this new book is to identify the problems that are most urgent and that are being worked on, and that in a way those challenges get overcome through a very widespread, engaged, collective theorizing that goes on in movements. That seems to me something like your retroviral activities.
That sort of thing. But it does require a certain faith that there are the particles of an answer embedded in all of us, and that we will eventually come together to make, you know, sort of one big idea. I mean, is that – well, let me ask you this, uh-huh. Or I can ask it a different way, because you also write very openly about a political construction of love and how love itself has to play a part in this when these structures come together.
Well, you know, a lot of our work – the way Tony and I conceive our work, a lot of it is to rethink many of the central – concepts in our political vocabulary. It seems to us that most of the central concepts in our political vocabulary are completely corrupt. Democracy, for instance, liberty, freedom, communism itself we could talk about. But love, too, it seems to us, has been corrupted as a political concept. And one of the things that it does, one of the benefits, I think, of first benefits, obvious benefits of talking about love as a political concept is that you break a supposed divide between reason and passions, you know, as if political thought should strictly be based on reason and interests and exclude the passions, whereas, of course, politics always involves reason and passion. Love is both a force of reason and passion, I would say. But love – I mean, another reason for talking about love, another benefit is that love is both an extraordinary bond, maybe the most powerful bond we have, but also a transformative power. Like, you are changed in love. So understanding politics that way seems useful. But now – immediately one encounters a problem, or I see as a problem, is that most of our conventional conceptions of love are totally disastrous for politics. For instance, our conception of love as loving those most like you, even that interpretation of love of thy neighbor is love those most like you, those most near you, or even the conception of love as emerging in one, of two becoming one, of many becoming one. These seem to me disastrous in politics. These are a ways of explaining, for me at least, white supremacist notions of love, fascist notions of love, nationalist notions of love, ones where I think these movements actually are better explained not by their hatreds but by their loves, by the love of the same, by the love of things, so of those like them. So what love – for me, if love would be serviceable as a political concept, it would have to be based on heterogeneity and differences, like loving those – not only loving those not like you, love would be the kind of practice of a experimentation with differences or of creating bonds or assemblages through differences. Something very like this notion of the multitude, it seems to me. That's what how the kinds of bonds that love would have to affect in order to be productive in politics.
But it certainly assumes that we're capable of this and kind of built for it. And I should point out that really when this idea came into religious consciousness, the story that illustrated the way love and love of neighbor and self ought to be expressed was precisely by loving the other. I mean, it was a Samaritan hated by the Jews who would be the one who would help the absolute loathsome other, the Jew on the road to Jericho. That was the example. Now, it's been honored in the breach for 2,000 years since then, I would argue. But I mean, is this a way of saying maybe that that idea, the time has come to begin to recognize? I mean, this is what Marx wrung out of his political construction, right? Any idea of the irrational and religious. If we put it back in, if we honor the fact that passion, for good and ill, passion when it leads to racism, passion when it leads to altruism. Anybody who puts on a uniform and dies for a country has done something crazy in a sense. It's irrational, and yet we sort of glorify that idea. So it's in us. We can do it. Now the question is, do we do it for people like us or everybody?
I think that I would see Marx a little differently, but let's leave Marx aside. I think that is right that that we need to construct. I mean, there has to be. I would even say, that we have to train ourselves in love to create lasting relationships, and lasting political relationships. To create even thinking about love as a form of constituent power, of constituting a society that is based on open differences and relationships of open differences. One of the things that I've found, it's been interesting for me, as I say, Tony and I have been talking about this for quite a while with a great deal of hesitations. In certain contexts, it works well. Others think of us as too sentimental. Some of us accuse us of being hidden religious zealots. But it's interesting that I find that among young activists in the U.S. and elsewhere, among 20-year-olds, this is very much in line. It's very comfortable, very much in line of how they see their political activism. And I would say that the kind of bonds that I'm talking about, even the kind of debt that I'm talking about, interesting, like not financial bonds and debt, but the kind of social bonds and debt that people discover in the encampments at Wall Street, in the Spanish plazas, etc., involves something like a form of love as a political force.
Is that something that you see really taking place? I mean, let's talk about the vocabulary first, the obstacles to this. Yeah. I think you pointed that out. If you use the word love, you either sound religious or sentimental. So how do we do that? And yet that is the concept we're talking about, some kind of sacrifice for some greater thing that's irrational. Same thing with communism. I mean, if you use the term, you've just about ended the conversation. Mm-hmm. Is it important to come up with a new lexicon? Do we need a new vocabulary just to talk about these things? Or can we reclaim these terms and say they've been thoroughly misunderstood and now's the time to straighten it out?
That's exactly the alternative I find we're often faced with. I mean, me and Tony or people doing work like us, which is that either you can make up new terms, which I got to tell you annoys people when you make up new terms.
Because they say, he's talking about love, isn't he? Why didn't you just say love, right?
Or you can struggle over the existing terms, which has a great benefit because they are themselves embedded with a history of struggles and victories and defeats that are carried within the terms themselves. I would say, for instance, one of the things that I've been most pleased by and inspired by in the last year from Tunisia to Wall Street is the putting the concept of democracy on the agenda again. I think that in many circles on the left, the notion of democracy has been so corrupted that it's become unusable. It seems an embarrassment. Like any good leftist, I mean, therefore cynical, wouldn't talk about democracy. But I think that one of the wonderful characteristics, and I think this is part of the force of the inspiration of the Arab Spring, has to been to question and transform our notions of democracy, which doesn't – I don't see this as anything – this is not more containable or less dangerous because of that. In fact, I would say the power And the real radical transformative power of these movements is for their demanding a real democracy and a posing a threat to the existing Republican constitutions, to the entire constitutional order.
Is it possible that the pure dynamism of capitalism itself, a dynamism that perhaps Marx himself wasn't quite, didn't quite apprehend, how dynamic it is, that that's actually the thing that transformed this, that ultimately capitalism, in order to keep going and to keep as dynamic as it is, will bring about these changes? That, of course, is what the neoliberals kind of hope. But there might be something to it. It's a very dynamic process, and it doesn't brook any interference.
The dynamism, when everyone talks about the dynamism of capital, you have to always hide all of the hierarchies that it constantly imposes. In fact, one of the, I think, the massive initial successes of Occupy Wall Street was the recognizing how it's common sense already that there's an enormous economic divide in the country and there's a great injustice to that. It seems to me what you're saying is something I see you as repeating a certain Marx theory when Marx thinks that capitalism will create its own grave diggers, that it'll create the conditions for its own overthrow. And I'm happy to accept that on provision that we recognize all the time the anti-democratic qualities of the anti-democratic core of capitalist relations of production, of employment, et cetera, and the economic divisions. It's those hierarchies that I think – and those hierarchies – I mean, I've been emphasizing democracy here, but those hierarchies are certainly at the core of the entire year of struggles. They're often masked in people's readings of the Arab Spring, but certainly present there too. The European struggles in Greece, in Spain, also even in the tent occupations in Israel, and then in Occupy Wall Street too. I would say that that's also a core of the protests.
Michael Hart, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks, Frank.
Michael Hart is a political theorist. He's a writer. He's a teacher. He's the chair of the literature department at Duke University. And his new book, along with Antonio Negri, is called Declaration. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on the web, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Frank Stasio.